want to talk more about restriction enzymes, which are restriction endonucleases that I mentioned before. Now, these things were discovered in bacteria. And so bacteria make them naturally. Now, how is it able to build these restriction endonucleases? What kind of thing is an endonuclease? Chemically.
It's an enzyme.
It is an enzyme, but therefore it's made out of what?
Protein.
It's a protein. So how does a bacterium know how to build that protein? It has the gene for it, exactly. Like any organism is able to make any protein, it has a gene that's the code for how to build it. Well, bacteria naturally have these genes. They evolved them over billions of years. And the reason that the bacteria have these, we use them for our own devices for biotechnology, but the reason that the bacteria have them naturally is to protect themselves from viruses or viri. A virus attacks cells, as we've talked about, by injecting its DNA into the cell, fooling that cell into copying that viral DNA, which allows that viral DNA then to be transcribed and translated into viral proteins. And when you have the viral DNA and the viral protein, you have all the components to put them together to make new viruses. The cell is doing all of this. And that's bad for the cell. Not only does it take materials and energy away from the cell, but it can eventually end up killing the cell because it makes so many viruses that it explodes, basically. So, a bacterium doesn't want to lose any cells. It only has one cell. Right? So there's a lot of selection pressure to have some sort of protection against these viruses, against viral attack. Well, what happened eventually over evolutionary time is that bacteria evolved endonucleases. Endonucleases that are able to snip DNA into smaller pieces. So the idea here is that if a virus is successful in infecting the bacterium and injecting the viral DNA into the bacterium, then if the bacterium snips that long viral DNA piece into little bits, it will no longer be able to function. In other words, yeah, the bacterium got infected, but no big deal, because the DNA is rendered useless if you cut it into little small enough chunks. All right, so that's what these endonucleases do. They break bonds between nucleotides, and those bonds, remember, are the phosphodiester bonds that you find between each sugar and the next phosphate on that chain. All right. Now, there are different kinds of endonucleases, and each one is specific for a certain sequence of nucleotides that it looks for. Okay, these places that a specific kind of endonuclease is able to recognize on the DNA are called recognition sites. But keep in mind how DNA is built. DNA can be described as just a sequence of letters, right? A's, T's, C's, and G's. So the overall DNA molecule has a specific sequence. But within that sequence, you can take a small number of nucleotides at any given point, and it has its own little sequence as well. These endonucleases are able to recognize short sequences, but each different kind of endonuclease is only able to recognize its own specific sequence. All right? If the DNA has that sequence in it, The endonuclease will recognize it, bind right there, and snip it into, cut it right there at the recognition site. If there aren't any instances of that specific little sequence within the entire DNA, the endonuclease will do nothing to the DNA. It just won't recognize it. Right? So there are different kinds of endonucleases. Let's look at slide 2, which I've already shown you. This is a picture that we already looked at about how DNA is built, but let me just remind you how the sugar phosphate backbone is. Each phosphodiester bond is represented here by a line between a phosphate and the sugar of the next nucleotide. So remember that a nucleotide by itself is the sugar, the nitrogenous base, and the phosphate combined. So this is one nucleotide, this is another one. And these two adjacent nucleotides are sewed together by the covalent bond between the phosphate of one nucleotide and the sugar of the next one. And that is what a phosphodiester bond is. Well, that's exactly what these endonucleases snip. Remember that the nitrogenous bases are not at all involved in holding together the nucleotides of one strand. They are just hanging off the edge. But it's the nitrogenous bases, and only the nitrogenous bases, that give this strand its uniqueness. Otherwise, if there was only one kind of nucleotide, all DNA would be identical, right? Well, the enzymes read the nitrogenous bases, the sequence of nitrogenous bases, but when they break the bonds after recognizing the sequence, it's the bonds between the sugar and the phosphate that's broken. Okay? We've already looked at this slide as well. Slide 3 shows you a piece of DNA that is undergoing replication. And the reason this is important is because it points out that the nitrogenous bases have a specific sequence. It's that sequence that needs to be perfectly copied when DNA gets copied. Now, what do we have here? But I mean, not pre-grown, right?
No. So these seem to be, these are ready to go. You guys.
Okay. Thanks. Okay, so this specific sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's, that's what determines this individual's DNA code. That needs to be preserved in the replication process. So it's those nitrogenous bases that are hanging off that serve as the code, but they are not at all involved in this backbone. So similarly, a restriction enzyme is able to basically read this whole code. It's able to scan the DNA from one end to the other. And if it sees its specific code, you know, GGACT, whatever the code that is that nucleotide's sequence, if it finds it, it's going to snip it. And if it snips the DNA into little pieces, you basically ruin the genes. You're like, it would be like tearing manuals apart, mixing them all up, and no one would be able to read any individual manual in that case, and therefore you wouldn't be able to make proteins, and therefore you wouldn't be able to assemble new viruses. Even though you have all the viral DNA in there, if it's split and just mixed up, it no longer is a useful code. So you can't make the proteins, the bacterium doesn't make those proteins, which is good for the bacterium, because those proteins would be viral proteins. Therefore, the bacterium protects itself because it's not going to make new viruses when it gets infected. Now, these endonucleases are dangerous things for a bacterium to have around. Why is that? Yeah, why are they dangerous for the bacterium? Yeah, because bacteria have their own DNA, which is absolutely vital for them to have. Endonucleases don't care where that DNA came from. If the sequence is in the own bacterium's DNA, then it'll be the endonuclease will cut it. So bacteria protect themselves from their own endonucleases by attaching methyl groups to their DNA. This is called methylation. Methylation of DNA basically protects the bacterial DNA from endonucleases. Well, viruses don't have methylated DNA, so they're not protected, which is just fine for the bacterium. Anyway, let's look at slide 4. This table shows you some restriction enzymes, restriction endonucleases. They all have a cryptic code. Don't worry about individual codes. These are just their names, though. By the way, the enzymes themselves get their name from the name of the bacterium that naturally produces them. So, for instance, ECOR1 comes from E. coli. The ECO comes from E. coli. R for restriction, and so on. But it doesn't matter how they're named. They all have these kind of cryptic names. But what's important about each one here in this is that each individual enzyme has its own sequence of DNA that it's able to recognize. Each one has its own recognition sequence. Now, remember we talked about the anti-parallel nature of DNA, so that each individual strand of DNA has a 5' end and a 3' end? Well, when you consider any little subsequence within that overall sequence, it too has its own 3' end and 5' end. So that's why you see 3' and 5' here. You see two rows for each enzyme. You see two rows of letters. For what reason? Why do you see two? Why? Exactly. It has two strands. So the 5' sequence is on one strand, the 3' sequence is on the other strand, and notice, as you'd expect, the two are complementary to each other. So wherever you see an A on one strand, you see a T on the other, C with a G. Okay, but these are very short sequences, notice. And that's important. The longer the sequence you have, the less likely it is that a random piece of DNA is going to contain that code, right? That make sense? If you have a short sequence, you know, if you only had one, every DNA is going to contain an A. Everyone's going to contain a T. But the shorter the sequence is, the more likely it is to find that in the DNA. And so the bacterium doesn't know beforehand what kind of virus is going to attack it. But if it has a short sequence that its endonuclease is able to recognize, then chances are pretty good that any virus will have at least one of those sequences in it, in its code, and therefore be able to be cut. Okay, so they're short sequences. They're not all the same length, but they're all pretty short. Another important thing to recognize about these sequences is that they are palindromes. Does anyone know what a palindrome is?
It's like when it's written, it's the same thing written backwards and frontwards.
Exactly. Something that is the same backwards as forward is a palindrome. So there's a lot of these in language. For instance, a man, a plan, a canal, Panama. When you read that backwards, it's exactly the same thing. Right? A man, a plan, a canal, Panama. Or Bob. Or a Toyota. Or Abel was I, ear I sought, Elba. Ear meaning before. Napoleon was exiled to the island of Elba. Well, that's the same thing backwards. Okay, so that's what a palindrome is in language. In terms of DNA, a palindrome refers to a sequence in which one strand has the same sequence as the other one in reverse. So if you read this right here, GATATC is the same thing as the other one read in reverse, GATATC. Right? Which it wouldn't have to be. You know, if you just randomly choose a sequence, when you fill this in, this is going to be a C, this is going to be a T, a G, an A, and a T. This reading this way is not the same thing as this reading this way. So that's not a palindrome. Well, the restriction sites, the sequences that endonucleases are able to recognize, are palindromes. Okay? And they're short palindromes. So these are just some examples. Now, we're looking at in slide five, we're looking at the plasmid that we are actually going to be using. This is the PGLO plasmid because the gene of interest here is the PGLO gene, or the GFP gene. What does GFP stand for? Green fluorescence protein. Exactly. Now, the ORI here, just to orient you, the ORI is short for the origin of replication, which I don't remember whether I talked about or not, but when a piece of DNA replicates, has to know where to start. In this particular PGLO plasmid, this is where it would start, but it's otherwise, it's no different from the rest of it. You know, all of this is just A's, T's, C's, and G's, remember. The whole circumference is just a sequence of nucleotides, because this is DNA. Now, the ARAC gene, which is represented by this green arrow, and the reason that it's an arrow is because when you read a gene, you have to read it in the right direction. So the sequence that you read in this direction is the gene called ARAC because it confers resistance to arabinose specifically. This one has nothing to do with antibiotic resistance. This one has to do with a sugar called arabinose. Which, if arabinose is present, then this gene will be transcribed. Okay? And the gene that gets transcribed, I mean, like any gene, it will create a protein. That protein really operates for the use of this arabinose sugar as fuel. But the reason it's important here is because this ARAC gene and this GFP gene, which is the one that you really care about, they are both controlled by the presence of arabinose. Okay, so if arabinose is not present in the medium, even though these genes exist, even if they are in the bacterium, if there's no arabinose in the immediate surroundings, then these genes won't get turned on. That's an important thing to know about genes, is that they're not always active. Gene expression occurs only if the gene is activated. And so genes get turned on and off within a cell all the time. You don't want to be making every kind of protein you're able to make. You only want to be making the proteins that are necessary for the moment. All right? Well, this arabinose sugar basically acts like a switch that will turn on these genes. This GFP gene will not be turned on unless arabinose is present. Okay? And if the gene's not turned on, what does that mean?
to transfer the PGLO?
It's not going to transcribe the PGLO gene. Right. If a gene is turned off, that means it will not be transcribed. If it's not transcribed, you make no messenger RNA. You still have the gene there. You just don't. It's like not reading the manual. So you don't make the messenger RNA molecule, and if you don't have the messenger RNA, then you can't translate that into a protein, which means you don't end up making the green fluorescence protein, even if you have the gene. And of course, if you don't make the green fluorescence protein, then you're not going to fluoresce or glow, even though you have the gene that allows you to glow. All right? So keep that in mind once we look at our results later, that arabinose acts as a switch, and you won't expect a bacterium, even if it's successfully transformed, to glow unless there's arabinose in the medium. Okay? The BLA is the one that confers resistance to ampicillin. Okay? So BLA is the marker gene here. BLA is the one that allows us to be able to kill the ones that we're not interested in, the ones that do not take up this plasmid, and allow the ones who do take the plasmid up to survive. So, before I go to the next one, let's just consider what's happening here. You take your plasmid, you expose those plasmids to the bacteria that normally do not have the plasmid in them, just normal run-of-the-mill E. coli. You give it calcium chloride and just the right temperature to increase the competence, to make as high a fraction of the bacteria as possible take it up. But most of them still won't, right? You plate those out onto fresh agar plates, and they will grow, unless they're on a plate that has ampicillin, in which case the only ones who will grow are ones that successfully did take up the PGLO plasmid. Okay? But if all you have on your agar is food, basically, so that they can survive, and ampicillin, you're going to have transformed bacteria growing on that, and only transformed ones. But you still wouldn't expect them to glow unless you also on that gel have arabinose. Does that make sense? Because having the gene, it's not the gene that glows. It's the protein that the gene codes for that glows. Okay? So the fact that they survive ampicillin tells you these have the gene. These have the GFP gene. So they have the capacity to glow. But they won't glow unless they actually use that gene to make the protein. And they won't make that protein if no arabinose is present, because arabinose is the thing that switches the gene on. Okay? So if you had two plates, both of which had ampicillin on it, you'd see growth of colonies on both, because they would survive. And both kinds of bacteria will be genetically identical because they both have the PGLO plasmid in them. But if one of the plates had arabinose and the other one didn't, you would expect only the plate that has arabinose to actually glow, because the other ones just have the gene possible to make the thing glow. They don't actually make the thing that glows itself, which is the protein. Okay, that's what we're going to actually do. If you do it right, that's what should happen. Slide 6 just shows you what's happening here in picture form. Beta-lactamase is the actual enzyme, which is a protein, that's produced by cells that have that appropriate gene. And that's why that gene, the one that I showed you on the plasmid that gives them resistance, is called BLA, for beta-lactamase. Shorthand for beta-lactamase. It's the beta-lactamase, that enzyme actually does not allow the ampicillin to kill them. But the rest of it we've already talked about. Now this GFP gene I mean, this GFP protein is what's actually glowing. But that protein is not going to be made out of this plasmid unless arabinose is there. So arabinose is the switch. And that's it. That explains the overall experiment, but we're going to do it in two bits. We're going to add the plasmid to the bacteria. That allows for the transformation. Then those have to be plated overnight, right? And once those grow up, then we can purify that actual plasmid. And we do that by taking ones that have grown on the plates that have the antibiotic. Now you're going to plate ones that don't have antibiotic as well. But why would you not want to use those for purifying your GFP?
Because it wouldn't kill the bacteria that didn't take up the plasmid.
Right. And those bacteria that didn't take it up would, in other words, just be unwanted debris. Right? If they didn't take up the plasmid, they are incapable of making the protein you're trying to purify. So you certainly don't want to have any of those in the mix. You want to include only bacteria that have the gene that allows them to make the protein you're interested in. But purifying the protein means just the protein itself, not the bacteria. So in that first step, you basically you segregate bacteria. So you're working with only ones that can make the protein. In the second step, the purification activity, you actually try to get just the protein itself out of those bacteria. And that's an important and difficult process that's part of science. You know, when we figure out what proteins do, which is a task in itself, you know, we do this all the time when we're trying to figure out diseases, for instance. If we figure out what a specific protein does, the next step is to, or I mean, if we want to figure out what a specific protein does, the only way we can really do that is to have a manageable amount of that protein, which means we need to purify. We need to separate it from all the thousands of other molecules that are present in the same kinds of cells that produce that molecule of interest. And that is a hell of a job, actually. It can take years just to purify a protein. And that's before you can then start working on it to figure out what it does. So that's why we're going to do the purification part after we actually demonstrate that the P-GLO transformation takes place. That's why we're going to have two different activities on this P-GLO one. Okay? Purification is second, though. Yeah.
Specific bacteria and protein.
E. coli is what we're going to use as our bacterium. It would work with other bacteria. It's just that E. coli is what's usually used. It's kind of like the fruit fly of genetics. Everyone uses fruit flies for various reasons. We also use E. coli. It's a model organism, easy to grow. We know how it works. So that's what we're using, although any bacterium that's able to transform could be used. We don't want to use one, though, that is hard to get, hard to grow, or dangerous. E. coli can be dangerous, but not if you treat it right. Yeah. Oh, and the protein is the actual GFP. So that ringed plasmid that I showed you on slide 4 or whatever it was, that is the plasmid that we're going to have a tiny little vial of. Millions of those little rings, we're going to pipe that out and put into our liquid that has bacteria in it, E. coli. Yeah.
You have a black light?
Yeah, we're going to have to look at these things under UV. Well, that's the other point. Not only does arabinose have to be present and transformation be successful, but even then they're not going to glow unless you irradiate them with ultraviolet, because the green fluorescence protein does not fluoresce under normal visible light, only under ultraviolet light. So once we actually have those bacteria to look at, we're going to have to look at them under special lighting. But they should glow. And then I'm sure they will. It usually goes well. As long as you follow instructions, everyone should get really good results for this.
It's an ultraviolet from the sun.
Yeah, ultraviolet, along with all the other colors, are coming from the sun all the time. Ultraviolet is what causes tanning and skin cancer. So it's not stuff you want to look at, but we're going to look at it with a special machine that shields our eyes from it.
So then, how come if the sun always emits it, then how come you can only see it from the UV source?
Because when we use an artificial UV source, it's just UV, so it's really concentrated. If you could do it with sunlight to a certain degree, but it would be so faint that you wouldn't see it, because most of that light is not ultraviolet. But if you have an ultraviolet source, then all of that light you're shining on them is ultraviolet, and therefore really causes them to glow.
Would
anything else?
Enough exposure to UV light to kill the bacteria?
It can, yes. Yeah. But depends on the bacterium. On the ones that we're using, I'm not sure, actually. Ultraviolet is damaging, though, to DNA, which is exactly why it causes skin cancer. Cancer in general is caused by mutations, changes in the DNA that you acquire over a lifetime. Cancer is usually not caused by a single mutation, but several mutations that have to happen in sequence. And so that's why the longer you do something, the higher the risk is of actually getting cancer. You know, you don't get lung cancer from that first cigarette. But the longer you smoke, the more mutations that add up over time, and eventually, once you throw that last switch, you get cancer. Anything else? Okay.